Content warnings for this episode include discussion of homophobia and queerphobia, and a brief discussion of body horror and gender dysphoria in the deep dive. You are listening to Horror Nerds at Church, a ridiculously queer podcast where we take a deep dive into a horror film and talk about how it connects to queerness, religion, and theology. My name is Pace Warfield May, and I am Jesse's amazing dance moves, I say with much sarcasm.
I don't know what you're talking about. Those dance moves were awesome. And I'm Pastor Emily, and I am the pool turned hot tub heating things up. Maybe a little too love much.
Love a good hot tub slash pool slash murder pool, I guess. I don't know.
That just reminds me of the SNL song skit of the murder show. Murder pool, murder pool.
So before we get into this very unique movie, infamous movie, I would even say. Just a few announcements. First, and the biggest announcement is we have our Halloween pet costume contest, our second annual one. Yay. So basically, what you do is you, from now until, what should we say, October, we didn't figure this out ahead of time, October 25th?
Okay, sure.
From now until October 25th, submit a picture of your pet. Stuffed
or
animal,
plant.
Or even plant, yeah. To bit.ly/HNACPetContest22. And you can submit your pet there, or you can just email it to us at horrornerds@church@gmail.com. Either way, get us those pictures of those adorable pets slash plants slash whatever else, and they'll be considered for our second pet contest. We have special with us the winner of last year, so they can tell you how awesome it is to be a winner of the pet contest.
It is, in fact, super duper awesome. So we will probably share last year's winner, my little Basil Shop of Horror, and maybe even share a like Gandalf highlight or something of one of Gandalf's many costumes. Or I might dress up one of my stuffed animals. Who knows? We'll give you some like ideas as we go, but it is it's really fun, obviously. And also, it is a great thing to win. So there's certainly like the grand prize, which includes a lot of stuff. Among it, I have like basically my favorite winter shirt ever, which is a winter Horror Nerds at Church shirt because I won merch. But also I have like a sticker on my water bottle that I'm drinking from right now.
Yay. So basically the grand prize winner will be voted by you. So out of all the pet submissions, Emily and I will pick basically our favorite five. And then all of you listeners get to vote your favorite. Mm-hmm. And whoever is the favorite, the grand prize winner will get a free item from our merch store, such as a t-shirt, but we also, if you don't want a t-shirt, we have tote bags, we have mugs, we have pint glasses, we have all sorts of stuff up there. And it's not only just Horror Nerds at Church merch, you can also rock out some Nerds at Church merch. So whatever, mm-hmm. whichever you prefer, anything from our merch store pretty much. And then there's also a little bit of goodies on the side you'll get with that as well for being part of the grand prize winner. And then randomly, one person from everybody who submits will be selected randomly for a chance to win a Blu-ray of Never Sleep Again, or it could be DVD if you don't have a Blu-ray player, and which is a Nightmare on Elm Street documentary. Last year, our winner was J.R. Lux, who was a guest on a few of our episodes. from last year. So they won Crystal Lake Memories, which was the the Friday the 13th documentary. So kind of doing a similar thing this year. And anybody who makes it to the final five will get a coupon to our merch store. So, and maybe even a poster, because last year I think I gave out posters.
Yeah, to everybody. Last year we all got like the season one posters, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So should I do season two posters or should I do season three? I think I'll do season four even. Who knows? It's been two whole seasons since our last pet contest.
Yeah. Well, we're in season four. We just started season four. So I would do season
two or three.
You could put season two and season three. You could, I don't know how much effort goes into creating the posters, but all of the images are already done. So you could let people choose.
You could have either season two or three. That's a good call. A little too long to have them both together. But season three was our short Twilight season for recap, and season, our mini season on vampires and Twilight. And season two was our Friday the 13th series.
Yeah. So, right. Like, you know that Kelsey Brown is gonna, if Kelsey Brown, who has been was a guest for our Twilight series, if she enters Cherry or Mango, she would definitely want the season three, because Twilight.
Good call. Or even season one. How about just give it, do it up to y'all. You can get one of our posters of one of our seasons. I'll just,
there you go. Y'all can.
So yeah, that's it for announcements. The movie we're covering, like I said, the infamous Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, Freddy's Revenge, directed by Jack Sholder, written by David Chaskin, came out in 1985, the year of my birth. Yes, boo. And let's see, Emily, when was the first time you saw this film?
Last week. I, unsurprisingly, saw this film last week. But I will say, what I think is interesting about my first, like, memories experience of this film was when we recorded with Nightmare on Fear Street for our episode for the first movie in this series. It was really interesting to hear them talking about it and then to watch the movie. And then I just watched Scream Queen after. And so to have that as, like, pointing out some stuff, but then also like to really be digging into the queer subtext and all of that was a fun way to watch a pretty creepy movie, which I watched during the daytime. Thankfully, we almost watched it at night, and that would have been suboptimal.
True. It's like with all the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, I can, with two exceptions, I can't remember the first time I saw it. I do remember the bus scene that opens the film, like this opening dream sequence on the bus, pretty vividly, like from early childhood. So I remember that one had stuck with me from this movie. Beyond that, don't remember much about it until like getting into my teenage and college years, doing marathons of the whole series and realizing then as a queer person just how queer the movie was in many ways, which we'll get into and unpack a little bit later. But yeah, so that's this movie for a long time. Also, I'll just say right up front that I think that this is the scariest Freddy. Like, his makeup is horrifying in the, like, the first one was he was in the shadow a lot, so you didn't really get to see it well. This one, they had contacts in, so his eyes were entirely black. There was like no white in them. There was just it, like, for some reason this Freddy is just scarier to me and has always kind of stuck with me as the scariest iteration of
Freddy. Well, and especially when he's like, there's so much more I think happening with him physically, like peeling off his, not even his skull, like there's no bones that he's peeling off. He's just peeling off skin to reveal his brain, getting a close-up of the heart when it starts to beat again, but also like someone who is already a burn victim. then being burned again and then like charred skin, like yeah, it's pretty intense.
Yeah. So I'll just like I said, well, let me just say this movie is infamous in several ways, one of which is among a lot of Nightmare fans will typically rate this their least favorite because it is unlike all the other Nightmares before or after. And so they say, so, and Emily, you haven't seen enough to really judge that part yet, but yeah. Like, it does take a turn with Freddy entering the real world, through possession, apparently.
I'm not convinced that any of this is the real world. None of this is clear to me yet.
Yes. That there's also that, but, so a lot of fans don't like it for that reason. And I think some of it is just, a lot of cishet fans of the franchise are uncomfortable with all the gayness in this, and that's probably why they don't like it. They just won't admit that, so they come up with other reasons. Because I really think this is a solid body horror film, and pretty darn scary. One of the scariest ones in the franchise.
What is a body horror film? What does that mean?
Good question. So body horror is a subgenre of horror that really just kind of explores and unpacks how horrifying bodies are. and usually by doing really gross things with the body. The Fly directed by David Cronenberg is a good example of this, where the body horror in that is as Jeff Goldblum's character transforms into a fly, like goes from human to fly, mutates. And so like these really gross scenes of like skin peeling off or like bones breaking. It's not just like the point of body horror is to unsettle the viewer by things happening physically to the body that are grotesque, disturbing,
that might make their skin crawl.
Yes, very nice. So David Cronenberg did a lot of body horror films, and he's probably the most famous one. But it's kind of a genre that goes back a long time. And there are elements of body horror in the first one, like with Freddy's face falling off and revealing the skeleton skull thing in the first one in one of the sequences. But this one just really goes in, like leans into that heavily with this theme of like Jesse having Freddy physically inside of him and Freddy like out towards the end of the film. Like that's just a very grotesque scene with the body and all that stuff. So
yeah okay, I agree, body horror, check.
Yep. So there's just a little bit of behind the scenes for this one, which kind of gives rise to some of its infamy, especially in like queer and more liberal circles who know about the behind the scenes, like some of the awfulness that happened. Most of this information is from Never Sleep Again, the Nightmare on Elm Street documentary, and also Scream Queen, which is a documentary specifically about this film, basically starring Mark Patton as he like goes on a journey related to this film. But anyway, so this film was fast-tracked into production, like as the first one was still in theaters, or like the first one is doing so well, we need to release a follow-up. So less than a year later, this movie came out. Like, just wild to me.
That's like almost as bad as the Harry Potter movies.
Right? But the Harry Potter movies were like based off of a book, so they had like something to start with. This is just like, we have nothing. We just have this first movie Wes Craven did, and we see how successful it is. How can we turn this into a cash cow? Mm. And that's with only like 9 months to do it.
Yeah.
So
Wes Craven was the director of the last one?
Yeah.
Okay. So they wrote the script last time. So it's like, why didn't they use Wes Craven?
Wes Craven was approached. He was not interested in doing a sequel. He thought the first film stood up on its own. Mm. And we'll come back to Wes Craven because he gets re-involved in the franchise later. So spoilers, won't reveal too much about that. But at this point, he was like, yeah, I don't want to be involved. I like the first one. I don't support the idea of a sequel for it. So if you're going to do one anyway, do it without me. So, and also some of the script ideas for the sequel, he just thought were really not good. Like the possessed parakeet, he thought was very silly. And the school bus scene with and the school bus scene with Robert Englund without his makeup on as Freddy, he really did not like. He wanted Freddy to, whenever Freddy's on screen, he wanted Robert Englund to have makeup on, because if you reveal what he looks like without makeup, it kind of takes away the mystery of it. So
yeah, and it's not always clear. Like, I had suspicions, but I don't actually know. Like, I had suspicions mostly because I had watched the movies that made us. And so, like, the bus driver looked vaguely familiar. But I did not peg it as Freddy. Even like, the whole first bus scene, I didn't peg as Freddy because I just figured it changed to Freddy. I didn't think it was.
Yeah.
Pre-burn damage Freddy.
So one of the ideas also that was proposed early on in the process for the sequel was that Freddy would possess a fetus. That idea actually comes back, so spoilers. But they did not go into that in this one.
I was going to say, maybe we need Susanna back for that one.
Yeah, that one is... Yeah, it's a little bit pro-life problematic too. We'll get there. That one is part five. Nightmare on Elm Street, the dream child. So, not the dream fetus, as Alice, not Alice, who was it in Twilight who made it clear?
Yeah. The fetus. Alice baby. Said fetus.
Yeah.
What's her name said? It's not a fetus, it's a baby. She doesn't get mad at the boys for saying it, but she gets mad at Alice for saying fetus.
Yep.
Ridiculous.
So, but yeah, so this was the script that they settled with, though. Originally, they weren't going to bring back Robert Englund either, who plays Freddy in the first film. They were like, he's covered in makeup. It doesn't need to be the same actor. Let's just hire somebody else. They did that. It was a mistake. They realized it early on that Robert Englund, like, really gave life to the character in a way that was so unique that it was very apparent that it wasn't Robert Englund under the makeup, so they brought him back. I don't think, if I remember correctly, none of the scenes exist in the finished product with the other guy, so.
Why did they not want Robert Englund? Just because he was well-known enough that he would have been more expensive?
That's part of it, and the other part is, in most slasher franchises, the person under the mask is usually just a stunt guy, because the stunt guy can do all stunts and stuff, but there's no acting or speaking, so there's no reason to, like, hire a named actor. And so they're kind of thinking of going that route, just A, to save money, but also B, then it's, like, easier for to do stunts and all that stuff. But they quickly realize that this was an exception to that rule in slashers, and that Robert Englund and Freddy are kind of interchangeable. So you will see later on when we look at the remake, if the replacing Robert Englund with a different actor works or not. There's a lot of controversy about that. That's towards the end of the season. So we have a bit. At the end though, Craven came back to kind of like check in about the production. I think it was because they're begging him to, because they weren't really sure what to do anymore. So he suggested some big changes to the end to emphasize Lisa. He really did not like the idea of there being a final boy. He wanted a final girl. So he really emphasized that Lisa needed a bigger role. So he's kind of responsible for that shift in the last part of the movie to like shift to Lisa almost entirely.
That explains so much, because when I was watching it, like, it is that Jesse is the final boy, and then at the very end I was like, wait, or is it Lisa? And it like, I got confused about like whose perspective we were watching from, which when done intentionally is great, and it sounds like it was not done so much intentionally. Interesting.
Then to the behind-the-scenes drama that is for part of it for me. And this is covered both in a little bit in Nightmare, Never Sleep Again, that documentary, but pretty extensively in Scream Queens. In Scream Queen.
Yeah.
Scream. So David, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Scream Queen really goes into it pretty well. It's also produced, Mark Patton was one of the producers of Scream Queen. So that helps make sure that the story was told that he needed to tell.
Yeah. So David Chaskin, who is the author of the script, the screenwriter, has for basically when this movie came out, it instantly had a reputation of being very homoerotic, very gay, lots of gay subtext, lots of queer subtext. And David Chaskin, the writer, has for a long time said that it was not him, it was not in the script. It was all coming out through Patton, the actor, because Patton, Mark Patton, is a gay man. And so he was kind of
throwing him under the bus
consciously or intentionally making the character gayer than it was in the script. And yeah, like you said, David Chaskin was just throwing Patton under the bus.
Yeah. Well, and the particularity, right, of this movie coming out in 1985 in the midst of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, of gay panic, of famous actors who are gay getting in trouble and getting dismissed and like blood tests before you can be an actor and all of that stuff. David Chaskin writes a gay movie and then is like, no, that wasn't me. That was the actor, all of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just so... So, and for years he said this and never once admitted that it was intentional until the Never Sleep Again documentary came out for, I want to say that was the 20th anniversary it came out of the original film. So in 2004 or around there somewhere. No, actually, I think it came out in 2010. So just a little over 10 years ago for the interviews of that documentary, David Chaskin finally admitted in that it was intentional. He put it in the script to heighten the discomfort and anxiety and horror, like you're saying, with the AIDS pandemic and panic around all that. He wanted to like add to the horror for cis straight male audience, basically thinking that if we make it gay, it'll be extra squeamy for the people in the audience, and using gay specifically as a horror inspiring inducing trope.
Yeah, and that's like, we talk about homoeroticism in the movie, but he talked about it as homophobia and as like intentionally putting homophobia into the movie.
Yeah.
Which is just like, what? Like, I get it. And also I'm just like, what makes you think that's okay? Right. And it's 1985 and everybody's scared. And
we talked about this in our season 2 episode on Jason Goes to Hell, The Final Friday, which that director, a cis straight director, did the same thing there and added a bunch of gay subtext purposefully to like heighten the horror and squeamishness for a cis straight male audience. But similar to this movie, it kind of backfires because then it just kind of turns the movie gay in a way that can be reclaimed. And we'll talk a little bit about that later, about like the queer aspects of the movie that have been kind of beloved by, become part of and parcel of why this franchise is so endearing among queer audiences. But anyway, there's a lot of punting the blame. We didn't realize we were making a gay movie. Chaskin and both the director, Shoulder, all keep saying, we didn't realize this. Nobody on the crew realized this, and just all saying it. But like, clearly they knew what they're doing. They're just making shit up. So yeah.
And like, one of the things that I thought was really interesting in Scream Queen is the interaction. Ultimately, Mark Patton and David Chaskin sit down together on camera and talk about this. And there are some people who like, there's one guy who before that had told Mark Patton that like, maybe he's putting too much on David Chaskin and like, it's in the past. Why are you still worried about this? Which like, the guy does not come, I don't know who it was, but some old guy, he does not come off well in that. Like, don't diminish the queer phobia that people who are queer are talking about. Like, but then when David Chaskin does like finally admit to it, he like never copy him on an apology. It was an awful apology. He was just like, I'm sorry if you felt like that. It wasn't intentional. And like ultimately for Patton, it was, that was what he needed. He needed to know, he needed Chaskin to admit that he had done it and that, and acknowledge that it caused harm. Yeah, and he did that, but like terribly.
Right. And that's something we didn't talk too much about, but the movie goes into. So definitely watch Scream Queen, but it really did have a very negative effect on Patton's life and career afterwards. He retired from acting really early, pretty much directly as a result of this movie. And just for a long time was really disliked by a lot of the fans and blamed for the movie and crew and everything, and just really awful time for the guy. But but if you listen to interviews of Mark Patton now, though, he is, especially post-Scream Queen, he is very supportive of the film, and he says that he loves the community that the film built and how the film has kind of become a queer, kind of a queer piece of cinema in its own right and been reclaimed in that way. So there's kind of like a little bit of a happy ending there, but nevertheless, this film really did contribute to harm for Patton and also to the, I want to say, to the gay male and queer community at the time. I'm sure it did not help at the time it came out.
Yeah.
Anything else from the movie, from the documentary you want to add, since you watched it much more recently than I did?
I think that's like mostly it. Patton, it was really funny. Patton was talking about how he first got an agent, and it was basically like he looked very pretty, and so they were like, he will get lots of commercials done. And he talked, I really appreciate how, as he has come back into a more public role, how he has approached that and the intentionality with which he has approached that to be really open about HIV status, to be really open about sexuality. And I felt encouraged, and somewhat comforted that like, he moved to Mexico, like found somebody and fell in love and had the space away from the spotlight so that he could heal physically, but also when he went through like the ravages that HIV was for him at a time, and now doesn't seem like he seems to be in a place of like being able to actually like live and manage his HIV, but he had the space that he needed. And it's just really cool. And it's really cool to hear how he talks about God and faith in that. Because there are, he and another person talk about that. But he has just this like beautiful, beautiful reflection on how God was with him in the journey. And there's a little bit of like, predestination happening of like God causing things that makes me like, but also like to be able to look back and be like, no, if it had been different, I wouldn't have been able to do it, kind of stuff.
So I definitely encourage all of our listeners to go out and try to find that documentary. It's available. You can rent it in most places digitally, but it's also available for streaming on Shudder/AMC+, if you have either of those. But anyway, I guess we can get into the movie now. I decided to kind of move away from like a scripted summary, so it's more outline style. So let us know what you think of this slight change in how we do things. But anyway, so the movie opens with this bus nightmare, which, like I said, as a little kid, really stands out to me as one of the more memorable nightmares in the entire franchise.
Interesting. I mean, it's bad. Also, the popular girls are the worst.
Right.
And I totally did not connect Mark Patton in the nightmare, in the bus nightmare, to Mark Patton as Jesse. Like, the bus nightmare is like extra nerdy.
Yeah.
And like not at all cool. Definitely not like a pretty boy. And then he wakes up and it almost feels like it's a different character.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of interest, it's always interesting to me how nightmares are portrayed in this franchise. And one of the things that I think does kind of resonate with me is sometimes your dream sona, I don't know how else you call it, like, especially in a nightmare, can be, you can in a nightmare be very unpopular, and those anxieties are being like felt even more, like your subconscious mind or whatever is playing through those anxieties about, am I really nerdy? Am I geeky? Am I really unpopular? And how that this nightmare could be picking up on that by making him look even nerdier and act even nerdier in the dream than he is in real life.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As you started talking about it, I was like, oh yeah, that makes sense. And the reverse, right? Like of in a dream, I think particularly for some trans people, right? Like the space to embody your body mm-hmm. in the way that you envision your ideal body and that sort of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, this movie is so queer. That like literally one of my first comments was like, okay, he just checked out the batter's cute butt. And right. then they get in a fight and he's definitely just hugging him. Like they're rolling around, but he just has his arms wrapped around him. Yeah.
And then they end up in each other's bedrooms towards the end of the movie, but yeah.
Right? Yeah, that was like a whole other level. I was like, and that's when they talk about the coach, which is a like complicated and feels problematic to me, but.
For sure, for sure.
And we'll get into that more in the deep dive.
The other weird thing about this movie is this movie solidifies something weird about the particular house that Nancy was in. So the house is like always hot. The air conditioning isn't working. There's like all sorts of weird stuff going around. When they moved out of the house, apparently Nancy forgot her diary in his closet. And everybody, I guess, forgot the razor glove in the furnace. They're just like, we're not going to move that. We'll just leave it there. Why not?
Yeah. Well, and they say that, I mean, I could see how Nancy would block it out. And it wouldn't be clear to Nancy what's dream and what's reality. That's the thing. That's why I'm like, I don't know if this is real or a dream or what. Because in the first Nightmare on Elm Street, it was in a dream that her mom had told her about the razor glove thing. And ultimately, like, she had gotten into a car that was then possessed and, like, took her and her friends away. And her mom, like, got yanked through the door like a doll.
Johnny Depp's blow up doll that got pulled through. As we were talking about that.
Right? Right?
Yeah.
So then I was like, okay, are they still in the dream? Or is the dream coming into reality or what? And then this one picks up and they got it. They bought the house because the previous owners, the mom was murdered and the girl went crazy. Like, so I was like, now I don't know what's dream and what's reality. Right.
That's kind of one of the fun parts about this franchise is it kind of calls all that into question.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we have to talk about the weird dance scene in his bedroom when he's unpacking. this goes down in infamy as one of horror's weirdest dances. Probably tied, I would say, with now I'm forgetting his name. The guy who plays Marty McFly in the Back to the Future franchise. What's his name?
Fox. Jimmy Fox.
No, not Michael Fox.
Michael Fox.
Not he's.
Oh, the other guy, the older guy.
George McFly. Yeah. What's his name? I'm gonna quick look it up.
Okay. I mean, Scream Queen talks about it as being from like the gay version of Dirty Dancing, basically.
Yeah. Crispin Glover. That's his name. So Crispin Glover's weird dance in Friday the 13th Part 4. And then the stance, I think, are probably the two weirdest dances in any horror movie I've ever seen.
I believe you. So far, this dance is the weirdest dance in any horror movie I've ever seen.
But still, it's fun. And I just love like how Lisa comes over and is like, observes it. Doesn't even laugh or anything. It just kind of has this smile and it's like, okay, I'm gonna help you unpack. So it's like, that's true bestie there. Clearly the forced love interest that happens at the end isn't real, because it's clear to me that they are just like gay bestie and straight bestie, kind of, or the what used to be called the fag hag, but now people call fruit fly because we don't want to say the F slur.
Fruit fly. I had not heard the fruit fly version. That's hilarious. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I do like Lisa's reaction. She's just like, okay.
Yep, yep.
Open.
And then, and also just continuing the theme of the first one, really, really awful parents. Like, my child, like, a bird explodes in front of me. So clearly that means my child is on drugs. Like, how does that correspond?
Like, you think your child is on drugs and wasted the drugs by giving it to the bird to turn the bird into a phoenix?
Right, right.
Yeah.
And then, like, the whole scene where he's on the ladder and the mom's like, he needs to go to a counselor or something and get help. And he's like, no, he needs to go to a methadone clinic. It's like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. And
maybe just check in with him. See how he's doing.
I mean, it's the 80s. Mental health wasn't as seen as much of a necessary thing to care for in those days as it is today. And it's, there's still a lot of stigma around it, but like, Jesus Christ.
Let's
never go back.
Yeah. I mean, there's, and we'll get more into this. I keep saying this. We'll get more into this in the deep dive. But there's some stuff that comes up that's just like, this is how we got to where we're going. I see, I see. But yeah, I think, is it part of the entire franchise that the parents are always terrible? Or is that, okay. I wasn't sure if it was like all of the franchise, the parents are terrible, or just the first two movies so far.
It just keeps going. And that's one of the things that I love about this franchise. And I think we should definitely talk about in a retrospective is that this franchise really, by and large, is told from the teens' perspective, whereas a lot of slasher movies, like, you get introduced to the teens, but they're basically fodder for the bad person to kill or whatever. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this, it's like they are all kind of given their own, like, little bit of pathos and agency, and it's really told, like, my parents won't believe me. My parents have no idea of what my life is really like and how many teens are kind of going through that without the nightmare aspect. But I mean, just like in
just life in general. I think
that's a very common thing that a lot of people, teenagers in that tend to share that in that experience. My parents just don't get me and they're not listening to me. And so I think this franchise really picks up on that. And that's one of the reasons why it's so popular with teenage audiences when it's coming.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that is consistent with how Wes Craven set it up at the beginning, right? With also kind of flipping some of the script around the role of women and girls in the movies, that it's not just a, like, you're fodder for the evil character, but that, like, you have personhood and agency as a full human being. What? Yep. Yeah.
And then we get the weird Lisa, Jesse, Grady love triangle.
So confusing.
So it basically, it's less of a triangle, more of a V. It basically feels like Jesse is trying to decide whether he loves Grady or whether he loves Lisa. And in true,
maybe he loves both.
I know, in true non-binary fashion, I'm gonna say, like, false binary, just, you know, date both. You can be polyamorous. And I mean, both of Grady at least definitely seems to return the affection. Like, everybody talks about how Jesse's the gay character, but it's like, I don't know, Grady seems pretty gay too, and pretty willing to receive what Jesse is giving.
Yeah, oh, he definitely goes there. And that's like, that's the other piece of, like, that's the other piece of David Chaskin throwing Mark Patton under the bus, is like, it was not Mark Patton acting by himself in a vacuum. Like, the guy who played Grady was very much playing into it, and
and also Robert fucking Englund, like, caressing Mark's face with his razor blade. And there's even a scene that was never filmed but was originally going to happen, where that caressing scene was going to involve putting the razor blade in a very phallic way into Mark Patton's mouth, and then Mark refused because he thought that was a little too far. And probably
someone told him. Someone told him. Right, like this is the thing. Like Mark Patton was going to do it. And then somebody was like, no, it'll look like you're giving him a blowjob. And then he was like, oh, maybe not. Right, like this is how much Mark Patton was not trying to make the character gay, but everybody else around him was definitely doing that work.
Yep. And Robert Englund, like what's very interesting about Robert Englund is he has this, he really takes the role of Freddy very seriously, even though it's this horror child murderer slash child molest. I mean, I think it's clear in this one that we can definitively say that in spite a lot of the Freddy apologists in this movie, it's very clear Freddy is not just a child murderer. He is molesting these kids, including the character of Jesse. And like, so Robert Englund in his interviews, he talks about all this stuff very intentionally and like really kind of exploring how awful this Freddy person is in the way he likes to toy and mess with his victims in very sexual ways. And so for him, it's very intentional too. And to me, we can talk more about Freddy's sexuality later, because there's a lot to unpack there. And by later, I mean not in this episode, like down the line. But like, it to me is clear that Freddy is not just interested in molesting little girls, but in molesting little boys as well. I don't want to say that's like a sexuality, like he's bi or anything, because I want to be clear that pedophilia and queer sexuality is not the same. But nonetheless, like Freddy does not care whether or not it's a final girl or a final boy or a final NB. He's going after them all and going to molest them all and murder them all.
Yeah, it's, yep. And that too, like, especially pairing that with the scene with the coach at the gay bar, but kink bar, but like there, when I was watching that, the question came up for me of, is Freddy trying to curry favor with Jesse by punishing the coach because the coach made them run all those or do the like planks or whatever?
Yeah.
Or trying to make the coach happy because the coach is kinky. And I know like hashtag false binary, but also like the coach is kinky and comes up to Freddy or comes up to Jesse at the kink bar, and like all of that just like plays into and feeds on the, like that's where it's very obvious to me that David, I have to look up his last name every time, that David Chaskin is homophobic, right? Like it is making a very explicit connection between queerness and kink and pedophilia, and that doesn't exist in reality.
Yeah. And also just that how much is seen in and of itself. This one scene proves that it's not Mark Patton's doing, in the sense that Mark Patton through his acting didn't magically create a gay kink bar for all this time.
Right?
Like how does that depend on it?
Like, that it's literally a kink bar. Yeah.
But anyway, and like the coach wearing like a leather harness. I mean, come on. That, yeah. Anyway.
Yep.
But yeah, and it's a very kinky, very, and,
yeah.
Yeah. It's a very like erotically charged scene. And that's one of the things that I find so interesting about Freddy is that he's a very like sensual and erotic killer. And again, this is why I find it so bizarre that people say he was a child killer, not a child molester in the original franchise, because it's both clearly. But I just find that so interesting about Freddy as a perpetrator of violence. There's always an aspect of sexual violence in there, always, and like from him sticking out the tongue
through the phone,
fancy, to sucking glands through a hole in his bed. Or the bathtub scene. Yeah, I mean, there's always some sexual violence in Freddy's actions, and that continues throughout the whole franchise. And it's very intentional by Robert Englund as part of the monster that Freddy is that he is this sexual predator and murderer. So,
And that's like even in the like almost sex scene between Lisa and Jesse. Like Freddie starts to come out. And like, yeah.
He's like, I can't have sex with the girl. Freddie, save me. And so Freddie saves him from it.
This is not quite how I would interpret it, but I like that interpretation. Yeah.
But yeah, the fact, I mean, just that scene where he's in a bedroom with his girlfriend or friend of some sort, panics, leaves that, and goes to his best male friend's bedroom, and where he interacts with his best male friend, who is mostly nude in that, just wearing underwear, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. Like, there's clear
a little bit more than that, but yeah. Yeah, no, and it's like, we already know from the last movie, boys are not trustworthy. And so then it's like, okay, is Lisa going to be more trustworthy than the guys were less, yeah, than Glenn was. And then we don't even like, and then it's like, before there's even that space to test out that trustworthiness, Jesse freaks out and runs and then goes to Grady. Well, yeah. And then goes to Grady and is like, ah, I'm scared. Please watch me while I sleep. And it's like, right, like he is acting crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, and then ends up, you know, killing Grady. And so it like proves the point of like untrustworthiness. Grady was about to go to sleep when Freddy started coming out of Jesse. But also there's this like I wonder how much of the idea of like white boys kill people, it is always something about mental illness, right? Like that's what always gets blamed. And I wonder how much this informs that narrative and how much that narrative informs this, right? Like it's a little bit of a which came first, the chicken or the egg, but especially with how many mass shootings we continue to have, it's just like, how, like, where did they decide that that was how they wanted to play it in the movie?
Yeah.
I guess. Yeah.
We kind of skipped over the weird-ass pool scene, which is just weird. Like, this scene is just so weird in that it's really the only scene where Freddy is predator among a large group of people, and I think this movie shows us why that doesn't work, because he's just like running around with his arms waving and like yelling at people, like not scary at all. So like I don't,
yeah, like there's some fear, but it's kind of the children and the children of the corn kind of fear, where like the second somebody bumped into him or knocked him over, all of that fear would disappear.
Yeah.
Because the way that he does fear best is through like the intimate one-on-one close-up kind of fear. Even the like pool, it just looks like a hot tub. It looks like a great hot tub, actually.
Right.
I'd probably
right.
Be like, thank you. I need a hot tub for my back.
For real, for real. And then they go to the boiler room and this is that weird, like, set him on fire thing that needs to happen. And there's this weird compet at the end. True love's kiss will save the day. It's clear the ending is, like, not related to the rest of the movie. And it's kind of, like, shoehorned in at the end.
That's what I was talking about in the behind the scenes, where it's like, okay, Wes, no thank you, but okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
And that, like, made it, for me, part of what it was that it made me wonder, okay, so is this Lisa's dream? Is this all Lisa's? Is that how we're, like, playing it? And does Jesse even exist or not?
Mm-hmm. And it could be. I mean, the franchise with part three picks up and basically ignores the events of this movie. So this could have all been a dream. Who knows? So we'll find out in part three what you think.
Hmm.
But yeah, I love the body horror in this. I love Freddy like coming out of Jesse in this really grotesque way is really chilling and gross and scary and all the things. One of the reasons I like this movie so much is just how creepy that is and gross and horrifying. And
yeah. It happens again, right? Like,
yeah.
Freddy comes out of Jesse, but then Jesse comes out of a charred Freddy too.
Yeah. Yeah. And we could, we're like at the deep theological discussion area. So, I mean, we could talk about like how that could be symbolic of something. And it has been interpreted in all sorts of queer ways of like him coming out of the closet or him coming, or like in a really like homophobic interpretation of him overcoming his queerness and living with Lisa happily ever after and these kind of things. So there's all sorts of gross interpretations of that. But for me, though, I think that body horror is so compelling to me and is like one of those subgenres of horror that just really resonates with me. That this movie, I think, is the scariest one in the whole franchise. Mm. I wonder where you feel on that. If this one you feel was scarier than the first one, or
it's different kinds of, like, it's hard to for me to rank like what is scariest, because there's a sense in which, like, as someone who was not very familiar with any of it, the first one was, I think, felt scarier just because it was all new, and this time I had some understanding of like Freddy and dreams and nightmares, and so I could like in some ways reassure myself that it was a dream, that it wasn't real, but then it was like kind of real and then it wasn't. And I think partly that confusion, whereas in the first one that contributed to it being scarier, this one I think it distracted a little bit.
That's fair. Makes sense. Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is just because it's my first time seeing all of them. But
Yeah.
I do think that the body horror, though, if we want to talk about that now, I do think like that particular type of horror, like it really does make my skin crawl. It really does. Like there's a visceral reaction that I have to that. As someone who like most days I'm really happy with my body. And I like my body. I don't always like how people react to it or respond to it in public, but I like my body. And so like the idea of something else coming out of my body, I'm like, I don't want that. And there's this like the original sin thing that like theologically comes out from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's been some stuff written about body horror and the trans experience in general. And just to be clear for our listeners who are not familiar with trans issues, gender dysphoria is often associated with trans people, but not all trans people experience gender dysphoria. So not all trans people have, I don't want to say issues, but have some sort of disconnect from their physical embodiedness that other trans people do have. So it's not like a universal trans experience. And yet there's been something compelling for a few trans authors, and I'll make sure some of the articles are linked in the show notes, about how body, many trans people just are very hyper aware of their body and their embodiedness in both good and bad ways in a way that a lot of cis people just don't even think about. And so having movies where these kind of fantastical and often grotesque, but still just these fantastical things can happen to a body has been interpreted by some trans folk as kind of an empowering aspect of horror. And I tend to resonate with that as well. That's kind of where I fall on the spectrum of like, I just find body horror films very compelling and kind of empowering and kind of a way to like externally process through issues of discomfort around one's body, and seeing that displayed on a screen can be very cathartic in a way. So just to note that out of all the Freddy movies, this is the one that really gets into that subgenre. And one of the reasons why that I would also say this movie is queer in that way too, even if it's not more explicitly queer like some of the other queerness of this movie.
Yeah, and I think that resonates a lot with me as someone who is trans and mostly happy with my body and have like minimal dysphoria. So there's a sense of like, it is a horrific thing for me to think, to like feel that way. And as you were talking, I was like, it's also like the hyper awareness of body is also something that folks, particularly who are socialized to be girls and women, experience a lot of, right? Like from, and they, I mean, they've done studies about like walking on the sidewalk, men, cis men in particular, but like men broadly never get out of the way for anyone, but women are always expected and socialized to get out of the way for men. And so like those dynamics of like where your body physically is in space and how people are perceiving it and how people are interacting with it. And like, I love wearing a mask all the time in public. Why? Because nobody's going to tell me to smile. And because it's a little bit harder for people to figure out my gender because I don't have one and they assume I do. And so like those aspects of like disconnect with body, I think really also resonate.
And the body is such a place of intersectionality here where like and this is something we can talk about if we cover the Candyman franchise in the future or something. Like there, the way that race interacts with body horror and the way that people who are not white, but people of color can experience a lot of the same hyper awareness of just existing. And I'd say as a fat person and disabled person, that's also the fat and disabled experience. Like I cannot sit in public transportation without trying to make myself as small as possible because I know of the perception of me as a fat person just, and the looks I'm getting, all those things. So it's just like constantly part of my daily experience. So it's just one of those ways that I think body, that just many cis white men who are mostly straight sized and able bodied just doesn't cross their mind the way that pretty much the vast majority of the world it does, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and that's one of the issues with like media being defined by this very narrow lens of the cis white male experience, is that something like this that's supposed to be in horrifying of this body horror can actually be quite liberating or empowering for other communities.
Yeah, for sure.
More in the queerness though. There's so much here.
Speaking of queerness.
Right. It's kinky. They go to a kink bar, which I think is fun. Like, it's not explicitly, like, a gay bar, but there's definitely, like, a sex dungeon-y, kinky sort of feel to it. There's people who are presumably drag queens. There's clearly gay men there, but there also appear, like, we can't judge people's sexuality just from how they're coupled or paired, but there are also a man and a woman sort of couples in there, too. And so it's like, but it's clear that this is a place where a lot of queer people can go to, and also people who are into kink can go to and have fun. So it's kind of cool to see that on screen.
I don't know if I've ever seen kink represented well on screen, actually. And this, like, there's a teeny tiny portion of time in which it is, because it's just a bar scene. And then it gets into the whole thing with the coach and minors, and that's not. But that little space of like, I can't imagine how liberating that would have been had I seen it when I was younger, right? Like before I ever came out, even like that would have been, who knows how I would have reacted. But
yeah. I have a question for you about the coach scene though, because I think I may have interpreted differently than you have. But I'm not saying that my interpretation's right or anything. When the coach approaches him, the coach basically takes him out of the bar and makes him run laps around the gym, which I always interpret it as punishment for him being at a bar underage. So the coach is saying, you're in trouble, and instead of telling your parents or something, go run laps and all this stuff, and we'll just leave it at that.
That's not at all how I took it, in the like queerphobic way of like, I see, and I think part of it is because of what Grady says at the beginning when they're doing planks, and like the way that Grady describes the coach. I don't remember if I have the yeah, I don't remember the like exact phrasing, but there was just like the way that Grady described the coach, what definitely felt like negative othering of the coach.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that like sets it up in a horror film where Freddy has already, where like I already have a sense of pedophilia because of Freddy, right? So then to have him run all the way around the gym felt more like, I'm going to take you out of here and you're going to perform for me. And then like, so it felt like, it felt kinky and, right, like he's not of age. This is not consensual, yeah. Any of that.
Yeah.
And so that's how I experienced it, especially because then it comes into the showers and we don't know how Jesse experienced it necessarily. Like we know it's not consensual, but beyond that, we know it's not consensual because Jesse cannot consent. But beyond that, we don't know how Jesse experienced it. And then to have him like strung up and whipped with a towel and then kill, like all of that, I think to me just like kept going.
Yeah, no, I think that's valid and probably more the intention. Just interesting that I saw it differently, but I will say something that is kind of huge about this movie for me is, especially what seeing this as at a young age, was the male nudity in the film, which is almost unheard of in horror and in cinema anyway, but the fact that there's a naked dude's ass in the film, like just, holy shit, this film is going there in a way that other films don't. And of course it has this like problematic specifically to create like feelings of homophobia in the viewer from what Chaskin was saying about his intention in writing it, but still like just showing male nudity, like it's almost refreshing for once compared to all the things we see in Friday the 13th of women.
Yeah that makes sense. I also like, I the other piece of the kinkiness was the like, daddy can't help you now. It's like that's kinky.
Yeah,
but there's, yeah, and I do think, like, I know this gets into the comp het piece, and so, like, it's a complicated thing, but the, like, the fighting fear with love that happens, because in the last, in the first movie, it's fighting fear, right, where she's just, like, stops putting her energy into the fear of Freddy, and then this time it's fighting fear with love, because there's not, like, a taking energy away. And so then there's like the I love you Jessies and running out through the glass door and like he's gone but not gone, and so it, there's this sense that love does repel Freddy in some sense, in some capacity, and it like makes his burn damaged heart start beating again or whatever because of the science class, I'm assuming.
Right.
And there's a like love conquers hate, love conquers fear kind of sense. And she like kisses Freddy. And I was like, that is super creepy to me. And then Freddy melts even more. And like inside is Jesse. And it's the like, who's inside of who is inside of who? And yeah. So that's the point where it's just like the compet and the like, true love's kiss heals all things. It's just like too creepy. That's it. This movie, I think, is more creepy because of some of the like compet stuff. So like more creepy, scary than the other one. But the other one was more like scary, scary from a like unknown.
The last thing that I wanted to get into about the movie, theologically speaking, is just this theology of place aspect, which is in the first film, there is nothing special about Nancy's house aside from just being on Elm Street. But like Freddy was targeting her in her dream because of the actions of her mother, and targeting children on that street because of the actions of their parents. This film kind of solidifies by having it set in the same place that there's something special about Nancy's house. And then this continues to be a theme in the rest of the series where, like, suddenly Nancy's old house is somehow very special and it's kind of like a home base for Freddy. And it's like, why? There's no sense of that in the original. Like, why is this special? Why is this house somehow unique to Freddy in a certain way? So I'm kind of just more or less saying that as a, this is a thread to continue to come back to as a series unfolds, and to just kind of be aware of it as we go, because I've always just found that very strange. Like, what is so special about Nancy's?
Yeah. And like they show the dad taking the bars off the windows. And when I was watching the Movies That Made Us thing, they talked about the house as like having kind of the shape of a smile, the like the windows as eyes and stuff. And so there's a sense of like the house as a character in that, like a little bit, especially in the first movie where like the stairs suck her in and that sort of thing. And I wonder if part of it is that that's the first place that Freddy does get revenge. Right? Like, if we are to believe that after the nightmare was over, Freddy did in fact kill Nancy's mom or Tina's mom. Nancy's mom did kill Nancy's mom, like suck her through the window and kill her, then that house is where he got his first revenge for against parents, not just in dreams, who killed him. And so then that like maybe makes it more of a place. But there's also the like hand thing, and that brings in like the understanding of relics, particularly in like the Catholic Church. And so like to have Freddy's hand or his glove relic as a relic in the house changes, right? Like it makes that place a place of Freddiness in a way that like a saint's hand or relic makes that place as a hallowed place, a holy place.
And also like the element, kind of piggybacking off of that, the element of Nancy's diary being this, like, I'm thinking of like in the Crusades when suddenly Europe conquered the Holy Land and stuff, and suddenly where it's like, let's try to map out all the places Jesus walked because there's something special about them and all this, and create a narrative like the Via Dolorosa and stuff about Jesus' final days in Jerusalem. And I'm like, that's kind of what Nancy's diary is doing, is like it's creating a narrative for this location that feeds into the reliquary in the furnace, I guess.
Yeah.
And all that stuff. So this was good. I really love how that conversation turned out. I was not anticipating getting to relics, but this is fun.
Yeah. Well, and I will be curious to see if the house continues to take on more of its own character, because it does, like when everything heats up in the house, right? Like it is the house itself taking on its own identity as a character. So I'm intrigued about the relic and like how that continues to play out or doesn't, but also how the house becomes its own character.
I'm so excited to watch Nightmare on Elm Street 3 with you, because I can't even tell you yet because you don't like spoilers, but anyway, it's coming. Well, I guess we're 2 rating the film then. Out of 10 nightmares, what would you rate this one? And do you have a favorite kill?
Hang on. Sorry. Yes. So first off, 1.5 jumps. I jumped 1.5 times while watching this movie. Jumps for me are also much more about like building tension and then a bang kind of thing. And so that's not the type of horror that this always is. But 1.5 jumps. And I would rate this film, I would rate it an 8. I really do like the queerness of the film. I'm still stuck on like the coach and like the ways that there's definitely homophobia in the film. But also I love the ways that the film really is queer and is embracing that queerness and the space to explore that. And my favorite kill is the coach in the shower. What about you?
I love it. I would probably say 8.5 nightmares out of 10. So like 8 solid nightmares and like half of like a half waking dream coming out of it sort of nightmare, I guess. And I rated the first film 9.5. So I feel like these two are a pretty solid 1-2 punch in the franchise. Yeah. Favorite kill. The scene with the coach is really a good one. And it's really creepy. And I just love how all the like jump ropes, and it's just a very wild, kinky death. But I have to say, watching it this time, that whole scene from Freddy first coming out of Jesse, and I think you were the one who said Wolverine style. Coming out of Jesse through the death of Grady, just like this very interesting scene. So I think that's what I'd rate for that one, the best part. Yeah.
I forgot about the jump ropes with the coach, which ties in, right, with the girls jump roping in the first movie and then with Jesse's sister, which is like a whole other conversation about like girls as props for horror, right? That like she is literally only there to cause Jesse fear because Freddy might go after her. But
Or her Fu Manchu finger. Oh, Jesus Christ, the 80s.
That, the Fu Manchu cereal. That was so funny. What a mess. Fu Manchu cereal. Yeah.
So, something, we'll watch something. Oh. I know what we'll watch. We'll watch Suspiria. Okay. So either we'll watch The Wicker Man or we'll watch a different 70s movie. So if we might be watching Suspiria, which came out in 1977, another very interesting witchy horror movie. So I'm excited to get a very famous horror film. So stay tuned for next week. We'll have fun.
Indeed we will. And that's it for our show. Our theme music was by Matt Warfield May. Horror Nerds at Church releases every Thursday. Please comment, rate, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support us on Patreon and get access to exclusive movie commentary episodes, BooTube episodes, and more bonus content by going to patreon.com/horrornerdsatchurch. It's only $5 to sign up. Cheaper than a creepy, haunted, possessed something house on Elm Street, for sure.
For sure.
Follow us on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Horror Nerds at Church, and Twitter at HNACPod for all the latest updates about upcoming films, news, and other announcements. Until next time, don't kiss creepy men.
Unless that's your thing. Like, we're not going to kink shame you, but...
Unless that's your thing, but hopefully you don't find them creepy.
Right?
Kissing them?
Don't... How about this? Just don't kiss child molesters and murderers.
Yeah, don't kiss child molesters and murderers. Yeah, that.
Yay. Till next time, y'all. Bye.